We have a very interesting and full agenda today. We're going to start out, the first two bills we're going to hear are House Bill 2333 and 2334 to allow Representative Krieger to testify on both of those. So we will start out by opening a public hearing on House Bill 2333. Representative Krieger, or Council, excuse me, ahead of myself here.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee.
House Bill 2333A relates to sex offender registration. ORS 181.595 and 181.596 require certain persons convicted of sex crimes to maintain lifetime sex offender registration in Oregon. There's presently a mechanism for relief from this requirement at ORS 181.600. House Bill 2333A revises Oregon's sex offender reporting requirements for certain specific crimes only. Those crimes include rape in the third degree, sodomy in the third degree, sex abuse in the third degree, and then the little used offenses of contributing to the delinquency of a minor, sexual misconduct, or the attempt versions of any of these crimes. This bill would apply to persons that are convicted of one of these crimes or the attempted versions of any one of these crimes, found guilty except for insanity of any one of these crimes, who committed these crimes and it was adjudicated in juvenile court, or if they were convicted of the functional equivalent of these crimes in other states. If any one of those conditions that I just described are met, then the person need not report as a sex offender if each one of the following is true. First of all, the person is less than 5 years older than the victim. Secondly, the victim's lack of consent in the underlying criminal matter was solely due to the victim's age, meaning there was no force or any of those sorts of factors involved. Three, the victim has to have been at least 14 years of age. So anytime the victim was 13 or younger, you have to register regardless. And then finally, four, at the time of the offense, the person had no prior adult or juvenile convictions for these sorts of sex offenses. If you had ever done any of this kind of activity before, you have to register regardless. There was a work group that worked on these issues. There wasn't entire consensus, but the bill was, it's a very limited number of offenses that this relief from registration requirement applies to. It's my understanding, this isn't in the staff measure summary, but there is a Dash A2 amendment to the bill that has to do with how does a person who presently have to register get relief from continuing to have to register. The amendment refers to doing so by making an application to the court by a sworn affidavit. My understanding from a brief conversation with the different persons involved in this bill is that there's some degree of consensus about making this application swearing to the sheriff as opposed to the court. That's not the way the amendment reads right now. So that's my understanding of where we are.
Welcome, Representative Krieger.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, committee members. For the record, I'm Wayne Krieger, state rep from District 1, and staff has really covered an awful lot of, and you were part of the work group and in and out, and you kind of kept advised as we moved this along. But it was evident that there was a group of men, young men, that with one offense who are now required to register as a sex offender, and the difficulty that it is causing them finding employment, housing, and even educational opportunity. And I think it needs to be stated that these people would still be these young men would be convicted of a sex crime and have to comply fully with all the requirements of the 18 to 16 months of formal probation. They merely would not have to register for the first offense. And it's really intended to give relief to that narrow two-year gap of people, young men, where maybe their girlfriend is 14, a freshman, they're 18, and some conduct takes place which violates the law. And it's interesting to note that if they're 2 years and 11 months, they can have sex for 4 years every day. It's not a violation of anything. But as soon as you get that gap of 3 years is where the problem comes in. And It really only covers, because it has most maximum of 5 years difference in age. The bill originally was at 10, then to 7, down to 5. You're really only talking about a two-year group of people, and that age kind of moves with them until the girl gets to be 18 and gives consent. So, and I understand the amendment. I think that probably would be an adequate way to address it, and I think you'll have people from the DA's Association and the State Bar, that defense attorneys, that can address that.
Thank you, and thank you for your work on that, Representative Krieger. We, the four of us, the reconstituted meth work group, met on this several times to try to deal with this population of people who are not repeat offenders and whose series of facts are different than many of the people on the registration list.
Yes.
Are there questions from the committee?
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Krieger. I appreciate you bringing this bill over here, coming and testifying. I see that the original time period was 10 years, and you've cut that in half. I also have a couple of articles in my bill file, one from the Mail Tribune and one from the Register Guard, with stories about these types of children. Why did you go down to 5 years? I mean, was that you just split the baby, or what was the testimony?
Madam Chair, Senator Walker, during the work group and some of the discussions with the DAs, the State Bar, people who were concerned, we didn't want to have a group of people possibly with this, you know, a 14-year-old and some guy 24 years old. That's not acceptable. So we did drop it back to the 5 and really tried to catch that group that we were most concerned about, that were probably in school together or new school. We're in school. She's 17. He's in his second year of college. And there's more than 3, but not 5. But it was really felt, I think, that a 10-year or even a 7-year difference in age was not acceptable. If you get a girl who's even 16 and the guy is 26, I would think that most parents wouldn't want that going on. And it's not, you know, a statutory rape. She can't legally give consent during that two-year period. But I think that's how we came up with that age.
Okay. I appreciate that. I just wrote a note to the chair. I'll be honest. I was 17 years old, and my husband was 23. We've been married 32 years. And that's a 6-year age difference. And I was out of high school. And, you know, I just think about that situation. So I wondered why you settled on 5 and not 6.
I guess we could say 6 or we could say 4. if you look at the different states, Madam Chair and Senator Walker, it varies quite a bit. The age of consent goes all the way, I think, from 14 in Hawaii. Many states are now moving down to 16. And
well, you can get married in some states,
yes,
Representative
right.
Krieger, when you're like 12.
Yeah, if it's legal to get married, then of course, you know, that would be different in those states. You know, there was conversation. I didn't bring it up, but I will. Today,
because I'm looking for it.
Today, young women, the way they dress, and cool. Oftentimes the women are the more aggressive of the sexes. And that's not something that we saw during my years. I mean, you know, the girls were quite shy, believe it or not. But today, that's not always so. And we had an incident in Gold Beach where this young 14-year-old girl actually put 3 guys in the state prison, and she was looking for more of this activity. And you don't charge her with anything, even though she's the instigator of it. In other words, she can continue to give consent when she can't legally do it. And if someone takes her up on it, they go to jail, and it's costing us because she's kind of promiscuous. So we're living in a different world, and I think that's one of the reasons you can justify that if it is with consent, not forcible, and you don't have a greater years of age difference than that, it'd be all right.
Okay. Thanks for opening that Pandora's box, Senator Walker.
Yeah,
let's not get Representative Krieger saying too much more on
no,
this.
Well, I don't think so. I think I'm not going to respond to that. I appreciate you sharing your opinion, Representative Krieger. I'm not sure that I agree with what you just said, but I appreciate that. And I do appreciate that you saw this as an important issue, and I think it is. There are many young people who are trapped in this situation, and it just was a matter of age, and it's not... They're not perverts. They're not doing anything wrong other than being of a different age. So thank you.
Chair Burdick, just a closing. You both, all of you, know my wife. Well, she was 18 when we met, and I was going to be 27. If that wasn't the talk of the town and the small community, state police officer, boys going out with this girl, I mean, there was all kinds of rumors. We didn't have a child for 5 years. So sometimes there's a greater age difference, but she was, I always referred to her as being legal, you know.
Okay, that is quite enough, Senator Walker. You are now cut off. We do celebrate the First Amendment in Senate Judiciary.
Oh, always.
Okay. Are there any other questions, Representative Krieger? I hope not. Sorry, Representative Krieger. We just have to give you a hard time. I'm going to do something I don't normally do, and I'm going to recess this public hearing. And we'll take this issue up and hear the rest of the witnesses to accommodate Representative Krieger. So we'll temporarily close the public hearing on House Bill 2333 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2334. Representative Krieger.
Okay, thank you. And again, for the record, Wayne Krieger, State Rep from District 1. He has arrived.
I didn't see you, Representative Olson. I'm delighted to have you here.
And I won't have to say much, Chair Burdick. Representative Olson worked on this and pulled his hair out four or five times over a year period. But what we finally got to, I think, is going to help the sheriff be able to have a refusal on some of these people, and he'll go into that specifically. I would only say before I have to leave is that on page 3 of the bill, A, convicted only once of violating ORS, and that refers to the marijuana statute, less than an ounce. A violation, and we originally it was just marijuana. And here again, when you're young and you have some discretion, maybe not isn't what it should be sometimes. One offense with marijuana to lose that right. We thought maybe if we went to the second offense, it would be more palatable to a pretty broad.
Representative, can I interrupt you here so that we don't totally confuse everyone in the audience? Just have the council run over the bill first, because your comments fit in context, and I know it, but no one else does. So,
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, House Bill 2334A, as we've heard, relates to concealed handgun licenses. ORS 166.291 lists requirements relating to the issue of concealed handgun licenses. These requirements include, but aren't limited to, person being a U.S. citizen, at least 21 years old, completed certain gun safety courses, no felony convictions, no misdemeanor convictions within the prior 4 years. House Bill 2334A adds three prohibitions to this list. First of all, that the person is not required to register as a sex offender in any state. Secondly, that the person has not received a dishonorable discharge from the armed forces of the United States. And then third, that the person has not been convicted of an offense involving controlled substances or participated in a drug diversion program. This third provision includes the violation, neither a crime nor a misdemeanor, of possession of less than an ounce of marijuana, but with the following caveat. To disqualify a person for concealed handgun license eligibility, the person needs to have either two violations of possession of less than an ounce of marijuana, or a violation for possession of less than an ounce of marijuana and completion of a marijuana diversion program. A single conviction for possessing less than an ounce of marijuana on its own, or having completed a marijuana diversion program on its own and nothing else, would not disqualify a person from concealed handgun license eligibility. House Bill 2334A also defines county residents for purposes of applying for concealed weapons permits, which is handled by the county sheriff. In addition, the bill amends ORS 166.295 to allow active members of the armed forces, the National Guard of the United States, or the Oregon National Guard to renew their concealed handgun license applications through the mail.
Okay. Now, if you could continue.
I'll just go back to the point about the second violation for controlled substance.
Could you identify yourself, please?
I've done that three times. At any rate.
What was your name?
Maybe you better just to get these folks.
For the record, Wayne Krieger, State Rep, District 1. There always is payback, and I'm very, very good at it. The issue about the second conviction or a violation of marijuana, discretion when you're young. The other thing is we talked about with counsel. I would believe that if you found someone who had the second violation, they probably were going to have other type violations that would have disqualified them already, some type of felony beyond that. But in other words, if they're going to continue to violate, they've probably got a bigger record and wouldn't qualify anyway. But this would give a little leeway. And I think the rest of the bill is really better presented to you by Representative Olson. And if you don't have any questions, I have a couple places to be at the same time.
Okay. Any questions for Representative Krieger before he takes off? Thank you for enlightening us today in Senate Judiciary, Representative Krieger.
Thank you.
See you later. Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Andy Olson. I'm representative out of the Albany area. And thanks for allowing me to come here. House Bill 2334. Actually, if you that is a continuation of where we were at last session and came extremely close to getting it to a place of movement. And then, you know, things just kind of went awry. But the two pieces that we worked on during the interim, Rod Harder is going to be here from the National Rifles Association, share a little bit. He was at the table. I invited a number of the sheriffs from the Oregon State Sheriffs Association to be there as well. Oregon Gun Owners and Oregon Gun Owners in America were present too. Darian wasn't there during the time, but he has helped quite a bit, do a little bit more tweaking and everything during this session to get it to where we're at right now. The two issues that we had, Representative Krieger's already kind of touched on a little bit, and that was an area that the sheriffs were extremely concerned about for revoking someone's right to have a concealed handgun license that dealt with addiction. So that portion right there, Section 2, the letter L, describes exactly what that is. And I think Mr. Stanford did a good job describing what that was, as well as then Representative Krieger's kind of touched on it a little bit. The other piece that was a big issue that we worked out finally dealt with principal residence, and that is on page 5, and it is also Section 2, and it would be subsection 9. And to be consistent with language in describing what principal residence was, we stayed with what the language was developed years ago for the ballot measure involving death with dignity. And the sheriffs were on board with that language as well as everybody else. And that's what you have with this bill today. So you have a good package here for the sheriffs as well as those that are involved with gun advocates to control and have good control with the concealed handgun license issue.
Thank you. And Representative Olson and members of the audience, I just think you should be commended for all your hard work. This is not necessarily the easiest issue to work on. I know that from experience. And you've had a lot more success than I have. And this is a very good product. So thank you. Are there questions from the committee?
Oh, yes, Madam Chair.
Senator Walker.
So if you've been a dope smoker and convicted once, you can get your license, but if you've been dishonorably discharged, you don't get it at all. What was the argument for that?
First of all, I guess I need some clarification, Madam Chair, Senator Walker. Dope smoking. Are you specifically identifying just weed, marijuana in this?
Well,
a little bit of everything.
Yeah, I mean, if there's mention in here that if you've been convicted only once of violating ORS 475864, which I assume are the marijuana statute.
That is marijuana,
and
that would be less than an ounce.
Right.
And see, that and the thinking behind that is because of it being a violation or an infraction.
Right.
It's not on the equivalent basis of your crime.
Okay. And you wouldn't want a heavy dope smoker shooting up with a gun.
Yeah. I think I spent 3 years working narcotics and everything. If you have somebody that has a conviction of two or more, especially involved with less than an ounce, you probably developed a pattern for addiction.
Right. But answer me that question, if you could, though, about the dishonorable discharge. On what basis do you feel they shouldn't be able to have a concealed handgun license? Not that I'm advocating that they should. I just want to know what the reasoning was.
I honestly can't answer that question for you specifically. That was some language from last session that we worked with that everybody was in agreement with,
mm-hmm.
Because it was falling in the, I believe it was falling within the guidelines of what, you know, federal government military prescribed to.
Okay.
But I mean, I can't give you that in detail.
Okay.
And I don't know, maybe Mr. Harder might be able to.
Well, a lot of this, isn't it true, was really aimed at, John, why don't you come on up? Was aimed at trying to get our state requirements in compliance with federal gun requirements. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's where that fit in. Is it okay if these characters join you, Representative Olson?
Yeah, absolutely.
Madam Chair, my name is John Powell, representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. I just talked to Mr. Harder about the question that Senator Walker asked, and he's prepared to answer that question.
Okay. Rod, go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Rod Harder, National Rifle Association. Part of this is federal law. The other part is dishonorable discharges are given for things such as murder, rape, treason, spying, that type of thing, and we didn't feel like we ought to issue licenses to those kind of folks.
So it's more than just, Madam Chair, it's more than just going AWOL. There are several other things that would qualify you for a dishonorable discharge, things that you wouldn't want someone to have a gun for.
Chair Burdick, Senator Walker, that's correct.
Okay. Yeah, Madam Chair, for minor infractions of military law, you would get a general discharge.
Thank you. Okay. Did you want to, are you done testifying?
Actually, I am. Just to give you a heads up, too, I don't know, it did pass on the House floor 58-0 to get to here.
Okay. Any other questions of Representative Olson? Great. Rod, do you want to say anything more about it?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm just here to lend our support for this. Mr. Sturr from Oregon Firearms Federation was involved also in the negotiations, and he testified in the House that he was okay with the bill.
Okay.
Gee, Madam Chair, I think we're going to get to vote for a pro-gun bill.
I think so. Okay. John, did you want to say anything?
Madam Chair, John Powell with Oregon State Sheriff's Association. I just want to thank Mr. Harder and Representative Olson for a lot of time. More time spent in the interim and last session than this session, but a lot of time put in on this, and the sheriffs appreciate it very much.
Thank you very much, and thank all of you for your hard work on this. This is not an easy subject in this building. Okay, any, let's see, we have no one else that signed up, but does anybody else want to come up and talk on this? Okay, we'll close the hearing on House Bill 2334 and open a work session on House Bill 2334. Senator Byer.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2334 to the floor with a due pass recommended A engrossed.
Senator Byer has moved House Bill 2334 A engrossed to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
As long as I elevate my rating from an F.
Try an F minus, Senator Walker.
I don't exactly have a great rating on the gun owners.
Any objection? So ordered. I will carry this unless you would like to, Roger.
Your choice.
Okay. Well, this is a good day because I've been working around this building for 10 years trying to get bipartisan agreement on a gun bill, and we finally did it today. So thank you, everyone.
Actually, what's the relating clause on that bill?
Oh, it's a very good relating clause, but that's not going to happen. Okay.
Ooh, related to firearms.
I think we will start our open a public hearing on House Bill 2127, and then we'll go back to the bill that we suspended before. Council.
Thank you, Chair Brodick, members of the committee. House Bill 2127 relates to the Juvenile Code and the crime victim constitutional rights. Oregon Constitution, Article 1, Sections 42 and 43, articulates the rights of crime victims during all stages of criminal prosecutions, both adult and juvenile. Such rights generally include, 1, to be present at and timely notified of critical events, 2, to obtain various information about a defendant's status, 3, to refuse to speak with or provide certain information to a defendant's agents, 4, to prompt restitution, 5, to transcripts of proceedings, 6, to be consulted about plea negotiations involving violent felonies, 7, to be reasonably protected from the defendant during a prosecution, and 8, to have pretrial release decisions based at least in part on the reasonable protection of the victim. House Bill 2127A revises the Juvenile Code to be consistent with these constitutional rights and in some cases then to provide additional clarification. The more substantive of the clarifications that House Bill 2127A provides include: one, absent good cause, a victim need not reveal the victim's address or telephone number to the defendant. Two, if a defendant's agent contacts the victim, the agent must reveal the agent's identity, that the victim need not speak with the agent, and that the victim may have an agent of the state present. Three, any pre-adjudication release of a juvenile defendant must include a no contact with the victim order. Four, the victim must be consulted regarding a juvenile defendant's entry into diversion programs. And five, a court may not release a juvenile awaiting adjudication if the charge involves a violent felony or if the juvenile poses a danger of serious physical injury or sexual victimization to the victim or the public. The summary references the -2 amendment, but I don't believe that those are under consideration today.
Okay, we have Mr. Attorney General with us today and a panel, so why don't you start?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. For the record, Hardy Myers, Attorney General, and I appreciate the opportunity to give some brief opening remarks to kind of give you some context, background on this measure. In July of 2006, a presentation was made to the Program Committee of the Oregon Law Commission requesting that a group be formed to develop proposed legislation that would incorporate the rights, constitutional rights of victims into the juvenile code. When the work program decided at that time that the commission was not able to undertake that project because of its total workload, I offered to sponsor an attorney general's work group to do so. And that work group was thereafter formed, and Timothy Travis, who's here with me, kindly agreed to be its chair. And with a significant investment of time during 2006, the work group produced recommendations that resulted in the measure before you today. And members of the work group included representatives from the Oregon Department of Justice, Judicial Department, the Oregon Youth Authority, the Juvenile Department Directors Association, the Oregon District Attorneys Association, the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, the Oregon Office of Public Defense Services, and Crime Victims United. So it was a fairly broad group. Senior Assistant Attorney General Kamala Sugar from the Department of Justice, together with Mr. Travis, will be walking you through the provisions of the bill in just a moment. While most of the provisions of the measure reflect a consensus recommendation by the work group members, a few of the provisions do not. During the work group meetings, it was noted that there were three areas of the measure in which the representative from the Juvenile Rights Project expressed concern that the language drafted may, in fact, be a broadening of the constitutional right in question. But the overall analysis and further discussion among the work group members produced an overall consensus that the bill does not do so, and the Juvenile Rights Project position was left as the, if you will, the minority position within the work group. The bill was amended in the House committee with some additional technical amendments, which were the result of consensus recommendations from the work group. I think these can be described largely as a matter of clarifying language and amendments for consistency. And I sincerely hope the committee will join the House in recommending passage of the measure to the Senate. I think it's an important part of the total effort to help ensure compliance with crime victims' rights in Oregon. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Questions of the Attorney General? Thank you. Kamala, you were with the DA's last time I think I saw you.
I was. Kamala Sugar with the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm going to invite Mr. Travis to jump in or interrupt me at any point.
He's good at that.
You have my written testimony, and you also have a comparison chart that I think was provided prior to this hearing by our department. It looks like this. And if you need extra copies, I have more. It's not attached to my written testimony, but I think it's a helpful comparison in that it outlines each section of the bill, how it compares to the actual constitutional language, and how it compares to the adult criminal code. So I'd invite any questions you have regarding the chart, as well as anything I have to say. The key points of this legislation are that the victims in juvenile cases currently, while they enjoy constitutional rights, those are not part of the juvenile code. When a victim is involved in a juvenile crime, while they might suffer the same trauma or loss that a victim of an adult crime might suffer, they don't always enjoy the same rights in the juvenile delinquency proceedings. This bill is intended to codify the provisions in the Constitution as well as the provisions in the Adult Criminal Code and give victims the same quality of rights and experiences in the juvenile court. That's not to say that in some courtrooms the judges are able to assert some of those rights on behalf of the victims, or the district attorneys are, but it's not, unfortunately, because it's not in the code, it's not consistent on a statewide basis. One of the primary pieces of the constitutional language is that there are critical stages of the proceedings, and those critical stages are different in juvenile cases as compared to adult criminal cases. And so this bill outlines what those stages would be and provides victims notice and an opportunity to be heard if they so request at each of those stages. Some of those critical stages include the pronouncement of the disposition, which is in comparison the sentencing in a delinquency proceeding, release decisions, safety of victims, violations of release agreements that have a no-contact order where a victim is placed in fear. Accompanying the concept of notice and an opportunity to be heard is an implicit in that the victim's safety, because if the victim knows about a release hearing, they also know about the release and then are able to take steps to be safe. Some additional pieces include victim privacy, exempting the requirement that a victim's address and name and other identifying information are provided to the juvenile delinquent, also protecting the victim's information from being in the petition. The current language of the juvenile code requires that we plead that if we know the city that the victim lives in. That would no longer be required. Some other pieces I think are worthy of pointing out include the placement of the youth in detention. One of the interesting pieces of the juvenile code is that there are specific crimes or types of crimes where a youth can be held in detention. This allows the juvenile detention facility or the court in a hearing or prior to a hearing, like if a youth is brought in at 2 o'clock in the morning, to consider the safety of the victim as well as the other factors in determining whether a youth should be held. It doesn't make it the only factor, but it's one of a group of many considerations, and that is a constitutional provision. Without any other comments, I would recommend on behalf of the Department of Justice that you pass the bill, and I would invite any questions.
Questions? Senator Barr.
Thank you. I'd like to thank your office for allowing me to see this well in advance. I appreciate that. Kind of a clarification. Section 15 of the bill seems to be a repeat of Section 2 somewhat. Section 2 is new statutory language. Section 15 runs ORS 419-145. And I'm just curious to know why we need to kind of put that in two different places.
Let me take a quick look, and I'll try to get Chair Burdick and Senator Beyer. Section 2 creates a new section that defines the critical stage of the proceeding, and it refers to subsequent sections in the juvenile code, the 419C. Section 15 specifically puts that provision into the statute that governs release.
Okay, so it just seemed like kind of a redundancy, but I guess it's not understanding the whole why things work they do, but it just seemed like it was redundant.
If you read the whole bill, it actually, there's quite a bit that looks like a redundancy, and it's for that same reason. Section 2 is somewhat of the overview of what sections would be encompassed, and then each section is individually amended to address each different type of hearing. along the way.
Yeah, and I guess I just kind of guess, it seems like you said it much better than I did. Section 2 is kind of an overarching new language, and then the rest of the bill amends existing statute. And I guess I was wondering why we needed both.
Chair Burdick and Senator Beyer, I think from a drafting standpoint, the reason that you need Section 2 is that it actually brings the constitutional language into the criminal code, which is critical stage of the proceeding. It defines critical stage of the proceeding, and it lists each specific hearing that would qualify. But in that section, it cannot change what is in the subsequent section. So each one individually needs a few additional words in order to achieve the goal laid out in Section 2.
Let me ask the Attorney General. We have a couple of proposed constitutional amendments that we'll be having hearings on, HDR 49 and 50. And if that changes the language of the Constitution in the victim rights area, is Section 2 still going to be relevant, or will this need to be changed?
No, Madam Chair, the two joint resolutions address the issue of the ability of victims to have a means to enforce rights. The resolutions don't change the rights themselves, really. So the joint resolutions do not have any effect on this measure.
Okay, that was my question. Thank you. Any other questions? Did you finish, Senator Beyer?
Just one more about Section 2, specifically the language on lines 11 and 12, except as provided in ORS 147.417. The district attorney goes on from there. And I'm just trying to figure out why are we tying that language into this section, because that looks like Mr. Travis would like to answer the question.
Yeah, me too. Chair Burdick and Senator, did you want to?
Okay.
147.417 requires the notification to the victim of constitutional rights by the law enforcement agency, which is, for example, the constitutional rights the victim might enjoy as notified by the police at the scene, which might be different than what's spelled out in the juvenile code with regard to the judicial proceedings that occur.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Other questions? Thank you. Kim.
Timothy Travis, Oregon Judicial Department. My piece of this presentation is really sort of deep background, because as you've heard, what this legislation is intended to do is to take the constitutional language and integrate it into the juvenile code. That was done with the adult criminal code in the past, but it's never been done with the juvenile code. And this became, to my mind, a problem when I was working on the Victims' Rights Task Force, and I realized that there's going to be a lot more scrutiny of our system vis-a-vis enforcement of victims' rights because of the work of this task force. And when I looked at the juvenile code, I realized that the lack of specificity in the juvenile code about this stuff was really a problem. And it's a problem because the juvenile system is different than the adult system in a couple of very basic ways. The most obvious of these is that in the adult system, the district attorney is really the key player in all the cases that are brought. In the juvenile system, the district attorney touches very few of the cases that come through the system. The Constitution provides that the district attorney is the primary person who's involved in supporting and encouraging the victims vis-a-vis their rights. That wasn't going to work too well in the juvenile system, where, as I say, the district attorney touches very few of the cases. So that was one of the problems that we foresaw. Another problem we foresaw is that, frankly, in the juvenile code, there's archaic language which just out and out contradicts the constitutional rights that are in the Constitution. It's easy to say, well, the Constitution trumps a statute. But when you're out there in the trenches, you are going to have hearings about that. You're going to have counsel who are going to say, for example, the victim, by constitutional right, is entitled to a copy of the transcript of the proceeding, if one is prepared, and if the victim pays for it. Well, in the juvenile code, it says they can't have one, flat out. So in order to avoid all these hearings, and in order to avoid the danger of sort of patchwork decisions, one jurisdiction one way, one jurisdiction the other, that's why we sought to do 2127 and to clarify as much as possible what the situation was going to be in state law. And what's really at stake here, if I can sort of just get general, is the integrity of the system. Every victim is going to get a card now that has the phone number of the district attorney and the juvenile department. That's one of the outcomes of the Crime Victims Task Force. That means that people are going to be calling juvenile departments and saying, hey, what's up? If the district attorney is not involved in a particular case, nobody's going to know what to do. We have to maintain the integrity of the juvenile system in the eyes of the public. Many of us remember the mid-90s when, justified or not, a significant number of people lost faith in the juvenile system. And the repercussions of that politically weren't pretty. So it's our obligation as the juvenile system to maintain the integrity of the system in the eyes of the public. So we have resolved contradictions and ambiguities, and we have clearly assigned roles to support and encourage the victims in this legislation. I was at a meeting of the Victims' Rights Task Force about a month ago, and Mr. Baloof, Doug Baloof, who some of you probably know as sort of the godfather of victims' rights in Oregon, at least from the academic side, and he said that to the group that he had reviewed 2127, and he said that he'd done it in the most nitpicky way that he could think of. And he said, you know, I couldn't find anything I didn't like. So I think it's a good bill. We work very hard on it, and I would be pleased to see you pass this out with a do pass recommendation.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much for coming. Okay, we will call, there one's neutral and one's in favor, but we'll call them both, Amy Miller and Steve Dole. Steve, you look so happy to be here.
It's a pretty bright shirt.
Welcome. Why don't you start, Steve?
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Steve Dole, President of Crime Victims United. Crime Victims United strongly urges passage of House Bill 2127 in its engrossed form. This bill makes numerous changes which all enhance the victim's access to juvenile proceedings. Throughout the bill, there are modifications which make explicit the responsibility of the juvenile justice system to keep the victim informed of pending hearings, plea negotiations in serious cases, and the use of informal disposition for violent felonies. In addition to the notification changes, House Bill 2127 also enhances victim safety by including the reasonable protection of the victim as an element to be considered in making pre-adjudicatory detention decisions and when the juvenile court makes a decision on release of a youth from detention. The bill also requires that detention release orders prohibit contact with the victim. All of these changes show a thoughtful and reasonable approach to making victims' rights an integral part of the juvenile court process. Prior to this bill, most victims of youth offenders were only given a chance to make a statement at the dispositional hearing. The need to be informed of other hearings, such as detention and review hearings or other motions, are not stated in the juvenile code at present. For far too long, the victim has been the uncomfortable person in the juvenile court proceeding. Victims have felt that their needs have not been met and have not been considered while the professionals negotiated and made important decisions. Crime Victims United does not in any way deny the rights of the accused youth or the youth offender, and this bill does nothing to restrict those rights. It does, however, make clear that the victim has a right to be informed of hearings and to be present at all significant stages of the process. HB 2127 also mandates consultation with the victim at several points under certain conditions. While the bill makes clear that there is no cause for action for non-compliance to these changes, and I think that's what you were addressing earlier, Madam Chair, to the Attorney General regarding HGR 4950, which hopefully will change that, Crime Victims United believes that the legislative intent is quite clear and that access to and knowledge of proceedings will be greatly enhanced if this bill is passed and signed into law. Crime Victims United would like to compliment the work of the Attorney General's Crime Victims Juvenile Code Work Group, and particularly to Mr. Timothy Travis for all of his hard work, and urges the passage of House Bill 2127A engrossed. And I thank you for your time, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much. Questions from the panel? Thank you. Amy?
Thank you, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. My name is Amy Miller. I'm a staff attorney at the Juvenile Rights Project. As you heard at the beginning, this work group began last summer with the goal of codifying the constitutional provisions which provide for the rights of victims, and in particular making changes to the juvenile code to reflect these rights. JRP was pleased to participate in that work group along with the variety of folks you heard from here today, and we support most of the concepts contained in this bill. And as you guys know, many of our clients themselves are victims, and we recognize the importance of their ability to participate in the juvenile justice system. We do have a couple of concerns regarding constitutional interpretation, which we've raised consistently throughout the work group process, and I just wanted to raise them again today. There are two. The first one is regarding pre-adjudication detention of the youth. The Constitution provides that a victim has the right to be reasonably protected from the youth offender throughout the proceeding. This bill, 2127, expands the grounds for pre-adjudication detention of a youth by adding the ground of reasonable protection of the victim to the long list of reasons a youth can be detained prior to a hearing. And for example, a youth can be detained prior to a hearing if the youth is alleged to have committed any crime involving a physical injury, a felony, or even disorderly conduct. In addition, the court may issue a pre-adjudication release order to prohibit contact with the victim, and victims may also get a stalking order. We believe there's already sufficient protection for victims in the existing pre-adjudication statute, and therefore we don't believe that this additional amendment is needed. I also want to point out that detention, even for brief periods of time, has long-lasting and critical consequences for youth, including negative impacts on education and employment, and detention itself is a strong predictor of recidivism. The other thing I wanted to bring up is regarding formal accountability agreements, which is in Section 19.3, and you might be able to follow along on the great chart that you were provided. The Constitution provides victims the rights to be consulted upon request regarding plea negotiations involving a violent felony. This bill basically says that the juvenile department must consult a victim before entering into a formal accountability agreement with the youth if the FAA involves a violent felony. Basically, it's our position that an FAA is not a plea agreement. Existing statute defines an FAA as a contract between the youth and the juvenile department whereby the youth agrees to fulfill certain conditions in exchange for not having a delinquency petition filed against the youth. And in contrast, plea negotiations occur after the filing of a charging instrument, are conducted with a district attorney, and the result is presented to a judge. In juvenile court, there's a clear distinction between these two types of agreements, and the Constitution itself applies to plea agreements. Because FAAs are not plea agreements, we do not believe that this constitutional provision applies. Thank you very much for giving me a chance to talk with you today.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's all I have signed up here, so we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2133.
2127.
I'm sorry, 2127. I was looking at the wrong thing. Thank you, Senator Beyer. And we will reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2333. And Council, this is the one on the sex offender registry.
Yes.
So we will start with Matt and Ann Shettles. And I want to ask our witnesses to please be as succinct as possible so that we can complete our agenda today. Okay. Thanks. Welcome.
Thank you for hearing my testimony today. And I'm Matthew Shettles, and in June 2004, the night of my high school graduation, I had sex with my girlfriend, a freshman who was 5 weeks from 15. I was 2 weeks past my 18th birthday. The sex was consensual. We both attended the high school for students with learning disabilities or emotional problems. My girlfriend had a problem with depression, as did I. She went away for treatment that summer, and her mother asked that I not see her or talk to her. It was 9 months after graduation, and I went to the school to talk to the transition counselor. She was there, became upset because I wouldn't talk to her like her mom asked. She told the counselor we had sex, and because of Miranda's law, school counselors are required to report this information to state social services, who report it to the police. That That is how the information on my situation reached the police and the DA. I told the police officer who came to my house exactly what had happened. I was charged with sex abuse too, but the attorney and I, my parents hired, was able to allow me plead to sex abuse 3, a misdemeanor. I was sentenced to 3 years probation, community service, and fines. I also am required to file as a sex offender. It has made it very difficult to find a job, and I've been unable to move from my parents' home because the apartment complexes I have talked to don't want a registered sex offender living there. I am currently attending school and have to register after every term. I received a sex offender analysis from Dr. Frank Calistro, the state's top psychologist in this area, and was determined not likely to reoffend and didn't need treatment. There are so many guys I know who have done what I did and never got charged. I met one prospective employer and explained the circumstances of my crime, and he said that it was a good thing they couldn't roll back time because he had sex with his freshman girlfriend when he was a senior and she is now his wife. I realized that I made a mistake in judgment and can understand the charges against me. However, it doesn't seem reasonable that a guy who had consensual sex with his girlfriend have to pay for the rest of his life by having to register. Murderers don't have to register for the rest of their lives.
Thank you. Thank you for coming. This is what this bill is aimed at, just this circumstance. Any questions from the committee?
Thank you for your testimony. I do want to thank you for that.
Thank you. And you're Ann Chettles, and we have your testimony, and it goes over some of the same material, so if you could summarize it.
Okay. And I also included in the written packet an email I received from Nikki Kilday, who lives in Cottage Grove, and Nikki couldn't come today, and so she wanted her testimony considered, and so I told her I would bring it here in the form of printing out the email that she sent.
Okay, and if you could identify yourself for the record.
My name is Ann Shuttles.
Okay.
And my son Matthew currently fits the total situation of this bill. And it's understandable that, you know, we don't want an older man having sex with a 14-year-old, but when it's classmates in high school, I think it's a different question. And I'm trying to cut it down. It's like we say that when she's 14 and he's 17, they don't prosecute. But if they have sex after he turns 18 and she hasn't yet turned 15, he can be charged with sex abuse 3, which is a felony. What's changed in one day's time? We give out condoms in sex education classes in high school, but do we teach the students that if they use them with someone younger than them, they can gain the label of felon and sex offender? Very few cases like this are prosecuted because the information often doesn't reach adults, but today, under Miranda's Law, any high school counselor as well as other adults in such a position who receive this type of information are required to report this to the state's social services agencies who report it to the police. Many of these young men don't realize what they are doing is a crime, or they don't realize the long-lasting consequences. And I think that's certainly the case with my son. After this happened, my sister, the former head of the Commission of Children and Families in Umatilla County, requested that the DEA in Umatilla County institute a program where they go to government classes and teach one class on things you are doing or might want to do that are illegal and what the consequences are. And I'm encouraging Washington County and have talked to Matt's parole officer, and they are working on such a program. I also think that many people in the state don't understand what the sex offender filing is for. Most people think that people on the sex offender filing are predators, or that they are some guy, you know, serial rapist. They don't realize that a guy who had sex with his girlfriend can be on that same list and have to register. a sex crime is the only crime other than murder where a criminal can be given a life sentence even if their crime is a misdemeanor. Having to register separates these young people from society and family. My son could not even be in the same house with my nieces and or my grandchildren, his nieces and nephews, whom he loves dearly and would never hurt. We finally got permission from the judge for that to be acceptable. He can petition to no longer register 10 years after his probation is over, and the district attorney has agreed not to contest that at that time. However, he'll be 32 years old by then. This is the period when much advancement is made in a person's life, including marriage and career. This could be your son, nephew, or grandson. Many youth today have consensual sex. I don't think any parent would like to see their senior son's life ruined because he had consensual sex with his girlfriend. And for that reason, I encourage you to consider passing this bill and allowing these young men to move forward with their lives.
Thank you very much for coming, both of you. You've put a human face on what we're trying to accomplish here, so really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Any questions from the committee?
Just one, Madam Chair. Ms. Shuttles and Mr. Shuttles, it's my understanding, because I looked at the bill as you were testifying, and it's not retroactive. It's only going forward. So this won't help your son at all, will it?
No, that was our understanding when we talked to the House, that it was retroactive.
Well, it's not. And if that was somebody's understanding...
Wait, let's have counsel.
I mean, not according to this.
Senator Walker, the section that I would... Section 1, a person otherwise required to report under sex offender laws and is not required to report, and if currently reporting is no longer required to report. If that, the intention was retroactivity.
Well, explain it to me, because I don't understand that first sentence, and I'm not going to have these people walk out of here thinking they've got something that they don't. So the Section 2 says this applies to a person convicted of or adjudicated for an offense before, on, or after. Oh, before.
Right.
Before. All right, Vicki, you didn't read the bill very clearly. Before, on, or after the effective date. All right, I didn't mean to scare you. Sometimes you see these clauses and they just look all the same all the time, and so I saw
I'm a
that,
tax accountant. I understand
well,
that.
Well, I'm very glad to hear that this takes care of this situation, because how old are you, Mr. Shuttles?
I had just turned 18 when this occurred.
Well, how old is he now?
I had just turned 21 Monday.
So you'd have to wait a very long time without this bill, and this is ridiculous what happened here. Okay, I've been duly corrected, as I am glad to have been done, had that done to me, and
good.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you very much. Okay, Kevin Neely.
Thanks, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm signed up in opposition to this bill, but hold on. Kevin Neely, for the record, representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association. The Oregon District Attorneys Association does oppose the bill as it's currently drafted. It's not an issue around the policy of the bill. Obviously, Mr. Shuttles, we believe, should not be registering as a sex offender for the remainder of his life. So the policy that underlies this bill is a good policy. Unfortunately, as the bill is drafted, because of the retroactivity provision that we just discussed, or that the committee just discussed, our concerns are that as it's drafted, it's going to be nearly impossible to effectively implement. There's no mechanism in the bill for a offender to apply for relief from the registration requirement. And so I had drafted the -A2 amendments that would have allowed an offender to essentially file an affidavit with the court. Once that affidavit was filed, they would no longer be required to register. We've talked to the courts in the meantime. I've talked to the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and I think we all agree that we need to resolve that issue. I'm not sure we all agree that that the mechanism I proposed in my amendment is the proper mechanism to do so. What I've already discussed this with Representative Krieger. I've already discussed this with the chair, and we're prepared to sit down very quickly and find a mechanism by which an offender who wants to take advantage of this new opportunity to remove the registration requirement can go through an application. And I'm using that term very loosely, but a process by which they are automatically approved. If they qualify under the terms of Section 1, what I've agreed to with Representative Krieger is there won't be any barriers. They won't have to go through a hearings process or anything like that. They'll simply have to file some sort of affidavit that affirms that they qualify based on the provisions of Section 1 of this bill. So again, once that issue has been resolved, I think that we'll be comfortable with this bill. The reason that it makes us uncomfortable is right now any sex offender could say, oh, yeah, I qualify, and there would be no mechanism by which we had the ability to go out and confirm that. They don't have to swear to that. They could just say that. And so we found that to be problematic. Again, I'd be happy to answer any questions about that. Right now, my commitment would be that, again, I don't think we can move the dash to A2s right now. I'd love to say that that's the right option, but we're contemplating the possibility of making that announcement to the sheriff. But again, we need to find a way to get the court order pulled out of the file. Right now, there's a court order. This bill doesn't contemplate how to get that court order removed.
Question.
Question, Senator Walker.
Why didn't you bring this up in the House?
Madam Chair, Senator Walker, there was a work group that convened in the House, and we brought this up. We didn't like the bill. There are still provisions in it that we don't like. The work group was not a consensus work product, and at the end of that process, the decision was to not amend the bill, to just move the bill forward. I'm sorry, the bill was amended, but the 10-5 was the only amendment I understand that came through. We had some other concerns. We wanted initially for there to be actually a petition to the court, and then the court would make a decision because of the retroactive feature of this bill. There may be cases that are not as clear-cut as the case you just heard. Mm-hmm. We wanted the judge to make a decision. Representative Krieger didn't want to go that direction, and I think based on timing and some other factors, they just moved through the amendments that didn't include that provision. Again, I have since talked to Representative Krieger. I think that everybody agrees we need to try and find a way to resolve the issue. And I wish that we would have brought you a bill that was ready to fly. I'm sorry that it's not at this point.
Okay, we'll continue working on that, and thank you for your willingness to
ask one other question, quickly. Please, yeah. Before you go off and try to fix this problem. Are we looking at, we're not looking at expunging the crime, we're only looking at expunging the requirement for sex offender registration, correct?
Correct.
It's okay. Not an expungement.
It's not really, yeah, it's just sort of not it's kind of a weird little thing that we're trying to do here, and I see why you're having a little bit of a problem, but it seems to me it could follow sort of like the expungement statutes and get it done. So you might look there.
That's a good suggestion. Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Walker.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Okay, thank you. We're going to have Amy Miller and Amy Elkanich, and I want you to be very, very brief, please. Are you all from West Sylvan?
Yes.
Welcome. If you want to stay for show and tell, some of you can sit up here. We're going to have a deal on red light radar here.
Oh, negative to leave. You're allowed to stay.
Oh, darn. Okay. Well, welcome. I'm glad you could come today.
Do you want to go first? Sure. Members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Amy Miller. I'm a staff attorney at the Juvenile Rights Project. I just want to testify in support on HB 2333. As you already heard, the original bill was much broader, had a larger age gap, and covered more offenses than the one you saw today. Although we're not happy with
we would prefer for the bill not to be narrowed in the way it has been. This is a great first step, in our opinion, towards removing some of these requirements for registration. I do want to make one point with the affidavit process. I just would like to make sure that the process is not unduly burdensome for youth, or that it requires a lot of process to file the affidavit or cost involved. A lot of these youth could potentially be on their own or could need assistance in some way. So I would like to make sure that that doesn't become a burden for the youth. I just wanted to point out that, as you know, sex offenders face social stigmatization, loss of relationships, employment, and housing, and a significant number also face verbal and physical assaults, according to the Journal of Contemporary and Community Justice. And as I think I've testified before, brain research on adolescents shows that adolescents have difficulty understanding consequences, and their actions are often a result of emotion rather than logic. The research I did also shows that treatment for juvenile sex offenders is proven to be highly effective, while registration is not really an effective deterrent. So because of the considerable detriment associated with sex offender registration, I would urge you to support this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and thank you for being brief.
My name is Amy Elkonich, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm here on behalf of Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers in very strong support of this bill for all the reasons that have been laid out. I don't think I need to repeat any of those at this time. In an effort to keep this short, we agree with everything that Ms. Miller said and Representative Krieger said. We think this is an incredibly important bill. I do want to address some of the implementation issues, and I hope everyone noticed that Josh Nasby just walked in. He's been working on drafting this bill. I think all the parties are serious about very quickly fixing the issues. We've agreed to work with the Judicial Department to address the implementation issues, which I agree are there, although I did attend the work group. I don't necessarily remember those being discussed there, but I do think there are problems, and I want to make sure this bill is as tight and as good and as strong so it can help so many people who need this kind of relief. So I hope that directly after this hearing, all the parties can step out and we can get something worked out and have this back on quickly. Thank you.
Good, and we do need to move quickly. We're coming up against the big deadline. So thank you for your willingness to help, because it won't work if it's unduly burdensome and if it's not implemented right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, I have Vi Beatty signed up for available for questions if anybody has questions of state police. Otherwise, we will close the public hearing. I'm not seeing no questions. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2333A, and we will bring this one back. Okay, now we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2508. Council.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, House Bill 2508 relates to red light cameras. ORS 810.434 allows cities with populations over 30,000 and Newburgh to install and operate red light cameras at the city's expense. Presently, Portland, or as it's defined in the statute, a city with a population of 300,000 or more, is limited to no more than 12 cameras. No other city has such a limitation. House Bill 2508A amends ORS 810.434 by eliminating the threshold population requirement and the Newburgh exception, which would no longer be necessary. It also eliminates the restrictions on the number of intersections in which a city can install cameras. Finally, House Bill 2508 eliminates a requirement that the Department of Transportation prepare and provide a report to the legislature on the subject each session.
And the lights are going down, and we have Mr. Campbell.
Chair Burdick and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police, and with me is Chief Brian Casey from the Newburgh Police Department. I'll make a few brief introductory comments, and then I'll let Brian talk about their experience in Newburgh, which I think will give you kind of a specific example of how one community is implementing this kind of technology to enforce what is some very dangerous behavior on the part of drivers. I want to mention that this bill seems ironic to me, because every time it's come up, Madam Chair, it seems like around the proximity of my need for a bill, you get a ticket, either a photo radar or a photo red light ticket, which I never think has done very much good for my cause. However, this morning I want to mention
what I sacrifice for the people of Oregon.
Absolutely. What I do want to say, though, is it's just ironic that this morning it was almost Chief Casey that was going to make this presentation on his own, because all kidding aside, I was about 2 feet away this morning from being hit by a large semi that ran a red light right in front of me. with a large shipping container on the back. And I just will tell you right now, my Volkswagen Beetle would not have been a match for that collision. And I shook for over an hour coming in. And this kind of event driving behavior is a big problem, you know. And it's personal for me because of this morning. It's also personal because I had a friend, close friend, that died at an intersection. He was hit by a red light runner, happened to be a California Highway Patrol officer in his vehicle at the time that he was hit by the red light runner. This is a very dangerous behavior. It's dangerous for any car that happens to be in an intersection where a red light is run. It's particularly dangerous, and we don't talk about it a lot, for pedestrians, those on bicycles, and those on motorcycles, where in almost every instance where one of those are hit, it's a game over, and we're all done. So that might sound like a little bit of emotional babble, and I don't mean it to be. I really don't. But I think we can make this too much of an academic exercise, and we can talk about facts and figures, and I've included them in my testimony because I think it is important to illustrate the point. I will say that surveys show that about 96% of Americans are afraid they're going to be hit by a red light runner. That tells you something. The reason I don't think I need to talk about statistics is I think your experience probably bears this out. If you've been driving around town at all, you've watched driver behavior as it's become more and more reckless and as intersections become more and more dangerous. And that's just the facts of life right now. I don't know if it's congestion, which creates impatience. I don't know if people are in a hurry. I don't know if there's just more reckless driving. I don't know if people are driving more impaired, but the bottom line is it is a problem, and it's a significant challenge for law enforcement to enforce the red light environment. The reason it's very difficult to enforce is because traffic engineers, when they engineer intersections, do not engineer them for enforcement. They're engineered for the best use of right-of-way. And from curb to curb, they're engineered for the purpose of traffic flow. It's very difficult for law enforcement in a lot of intersection situations to even set up for enforcement. Then a police vehicle that's able to observe a red light violation is given limited choices in their ability to actually pursue and pull over the driver, which often requires the police vehicle to go through the red light themselves, putting the officer and additional pedestrians and citizens at risk. The other option is to use more than one patrol car and to call ahead to pull over violators. The problem there, of course, is you're creating another traffic problem just upstream from the light, creating additional congestion and danger there. The problem is, for law enforcement, these are difficult environments to enforce. And on top of that, the resources necessary to effectively enforce intersection is very expensive when you could be using officers for a number of other calls for service that right now are not getting the attention they really deserve. So let me tell you just briefly, council did an excellent job of introducing what the bill does. Basically, it gives cities a chance to make this decision for themselves based on a city council vote. If you've taken a look at the process that's required for instituting these red light cameras, it's extensive. It involves a requirement to create a public awareness around this. And I think Chief Casey can talk about what Newburgh went through in terms of everything from public meetings to sending out announcements in electricity bills to on and on and on for the purpose of raising public awareness about this dangerous behavior. The other thing I want to point out is that this requires clear signage in advance of any intersection, and the reason for that is this is not a gotcha bill. It is not about the violations that are issued. It's not about the tickets. It's about changing driver behavior through voluntary compliance. And what you find is a lot of people, given a little check, a little reminder, adjust their behavior and make the intersection safer. It will not eliminate every red light runner for a number of reasons, but what it does do, based on the statistics that Newburgh will share and in any other jurisdictions that uses it, they have a significant reduction in the red light violations, and that translates directly into increased public safety. That's what it's all about. There is a report that's issued. In this bill, we eliminate one report that we consider a duplicative report. Every jurisdiction that utilizes these technologies has to submit to the legislature on March of every odd-numbered year a report that goes into significant detail about the process and outcome evaluations of what they're doing. That goes to the leadership in both the House and Senate and actually is distributed to each legislature. In this bill, we eliminate the requirement for the Oregon Department of Transportation to send out a duplicate report to the legislature, which the law currently provides, so that's in there as well. And then we remove an intersection limitation that's currently there. This is a very self-limiting technology. If it doesn't make sense, based on, in other words, you have to have significant traffic flow and a significant traffic problem before this tool becomes an effective tool. And so it is self-limiting. There are jurisdictions that have a number of difficult intersections. In Newburgh, because Highway 18 runs right through their jurisdiction, they have one in particular that's particularly dangerous. And what I will do now, with your permission, Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm going to turn it directly over to Chief Casey, and he can talk to you a little bit about their experience. And I deeply appreciate the chance to make our case, and I know that it's an uphill battle, and that's all right, too. But I appreciate the opportunity to communicate on this.
Thank you. Actually, I go through Newburgh, and isn't it 99 that goes through?
Is it 99
Newburgh?
Or 99? Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay, question.
All right. Now, see, I'm not even a credible witness now.
And I don't blow red lights in Newburgh. Never had a ticket there.
Do they have red lights in Newburgh?
Yes, they do. Many of them. Welcome, Chief.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Brian Casey. I am the Chief of Police for the City of Newburgh. I am here to talk a little bit about our photo red light program. Fortunately, we are one of the cities in Oregon that are under 30,000 that are authorized to have photo red light, as you know. And I won't spend much time here because you already are aware of the law, but we are exempt from the 30,000 population requirement. But I do want to talk a little bit about photo red light as it relates to Newburgh. And photo red light has been embraced by the City of Newburgh and supported beyond our expectations. There is conclusive data that supports the effectiveness of photo red light and its ability to do what law enforcement cannot do. Photo red light provides continuous enforcement at controlled intersections with undisputable degree of certainty, thus reducing the number of violations and making our highways safer. Now, I think the key there is, in that statement, is that the enforcement is continuous, and that, as I'll point out here in my presentation, that it's nearly undisputable as to whether or not the violation occurred, which is important to us as well as the violator, in addition to the safety. Okay, some of these issues Kevin had already talked about. Typically, there is nowhere for officers to sit and monitor these red lights. And as I show you some of these videos, you'll see the construction of the highway and the layout, and you'll see that there is not an area for officers to sit and monitor the traffic. Additionally, it's unsafe if they do view a violation to enter into the flow of traffic to try to pursue the violator. And this isn't just typical for Newburgh. I would suggest that this is the way most red light intersections are configured. Additionally, we don't have enough officers. Newburgh has 1.15 officers per 1,000, and it's interesting, but traffic complaints are our number one complaint that we receive from the citizens. It's a livability issue. We've had methamphetamine presentations in the community where we'll have a half a dozen people show up. I've had presentations in communities addressing traffic problems, and in a two-block area, covering a two-block area, and we'll have 60 residents or citizens show up for those meetings. So this is a big issue with the public, and I've been overwhelmed with the amount of support from our community for this program. Initially, when it started, I thought we were going to have a lot of people complaining and upset with the photo red light program, but the reality is that from our city council on down to the citizens of Newburgh, the overwhelming majority would put a photo red light at every intersection if we could afford to do it.
Chair, can I interrupt for a moment? Chief, you've probably already been alerted to my position on this bill. But let me ask you that last point. In Newburgh, 5% of all crashes were attributed to failure to obey a traffic signal. What kind of a traffic signal?
That I don't know.
Okay, so we could be talking about people running stop signs, correct?
I believe you probably could, yes, if that's what that refers to.
Stop signs, yield signs.
Stop signs. Our position on that, Senator Walker, Madam Chair, is that if they're violating a red light, they're violating a stop sign, there's really not much difference as far as the violation occurs. But
Chief, you're not suggesting putting cameras at stop sign intersections, are you?
Senator Walker, Madam Chair, Senator Walker, no.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay. And then just as a point of reference, the red light citations issued by officers are one of our most contested citations. They're difficult to convict in court. They present a problem as far as you have the officer's opinion of what he saw versus the opinion or what the driver views as their position as far as violating that light. Photo red light, of all the citations that have been issued in Newburgh, we've only had two violators that have pled not guilty and have come to court. These are some statistics from around the United States on the effectiveness of red light, photo red light. And you can see the reductions in these cities. Now, these are important statistics to me because they tell me three things. One, I was surprised at the number of violations, 784 violations at one intersection in Newburgh from that time period of August 1st through May 1st. Now, I want to bring this to your attention. Those violations, state law allows us to issue a citation if they enter an intersection on the amber. These violations are only issued when the car crosses the crosswalk on a red. And as you'll see in the video, I'll point this out to you, that these are significant violations. These are not people that are in the intersection and all of a sudden, boom, the light turns red. That's not how this happens. So there's 784 people that have entered the intersection on a red. More importantly, there's 485 violations that have been prosecuted. Those are 485 people that are not likely to run another red light. There are also 485 people that have been held accountable for violating the red light, which in any other circumstance in Newburgh, they would not have been, because we do not enforce photo red light at that intersection because it's nearly impossible for us to do. Thirdly, the 299 citations that have been dismissed, I think that's important because it shows the fairness of this program. If you look at the video of those 299 violations, there's no question those people violated the photo red light or the light itself. However, if there's any question, driver obstruction, we're not able to match the gender, we're not able to properly identify the driver because of sun glare or any of those reasons, and those are just about half the reasons why citations are dismissed, then they are dismissed. And so you can see nearly 300 of the 784 have been dismissed, and I think that's a sign of fairness to the program.
Chief, I'm going to have to ask you to summarize as quickly as you can, maybe 4 or 5 minutes, so that we can get our other two witnesses.
I'll just skip through this. This is our monthly citations, and I'll run to some video here. So you notice when the light turns red. By the way, these are all in Newburgh. If you'll notice that the configuration, turning lanes on all four corners, there's nowhere for the officers to sit.
Whoa. That looked like the guy that almost nailed you,
Ken. Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
And the pilot car.
You notice those are tracks in that place.
Yep.
While this is running, I will tell you that we've seen a reduction. Redflex had planned on putting up more photo red lights in Newburgh. However, they've gone back and resurveyed the three other intersections, and at this point, there's no justification for any additional red lights because we feel like the awareness program that we've done with this has really helped control some of the other intersections and the number of violations. This is the traffic accident.
Hello.
Notice the car stopped.
Oh my word. He didn't hit anything.
This car here is traveling at 55 miles an hour, and had it T-boned this lady here, it would have may cause some serious damage, if not death. Now, I just want to point this out. You know, I have to tell you, that was my impression, too, when I first saw this, was that I chuckled, and then I got thinking, you know, I have two daughters, and I would hate to know that that was the last photograph taken of her and get that in the mail. If by chance something were to happen to her. I mean, it does strike you, but this is a dangerous situation. But I want you to notice where her tires are on the crosswalk. That light is red, and this is when this photo red light actually kicks into process there. But you can see how clear the clarity of the driver and the license plate, which helps us identify.
Are there photos always taken from the front?
Front. There's streaming video, of front and back, as well as photos of front and back. When the violator receives a citation, they receive photographs and a website that they can go to, enter the website and view the violation itself. And that's why we've probably had 99% or higher success rate in the convictions.
Can you do it in the dark?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, there's strobes that flash. It's very effective, even at night.
All right. Thank you. Questions? Senator Byer.
Thank you. Kevin, I've been reading the bill, trying to figure out where in the bill it says that the city council has to pass an ordinance to do this.
Chair Burdick and Senator Byer, it is a part of the photo red light law, but not the bill. I don't believe it changes anything about what's currently done in cities that are authorized to do it.
Okay, so there's another statute that deals with how they get it besides 810-434?
You know, Chair Burdick and Senator Byer, there's probably somebody here that can answer that question.
Yeah, Troy's here. We'll ask him. Thank you.
Like they say, I'm good for five minutes on everything and 6 minutes on nothing. So I'm out of my time. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and I'm glad you survived your morning commute.
I am too. Thank you.
Okay, the two Marks and Troy Costellas.
Good afternoon, Mark Landauer with the Office of Government Relations for the City of Portland. I've asked Mark Lear with our Traffic Investigation Manager to appear and provide some testimony to the committee on our interest with this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Mark Lear. I manage the City of Portland Office of Transportation's Traffic Safety Program. Thanks for the opportunity to come and testify on behalf of this bill. Portland, over the last 10 years, has experienced over 8,000 crashes resulting from red light running, over 2,200 injuries, and over 23 deaths. We've now been using red light cameras for a number of years, and in that experience, we've been able to see a dramatic reduction in red light violations, 60 to 87%, One of the things that we notice right as we put our red light cameras in is that as soon as we put in the signs warning that the cameras are ahead and we start to do the tickets, we see a dramatic reduction just right off the bat. And part of what that tells us is that red light running, unfortunately, is an intentional act. Drivers get bad habits. You know, all of us get bad habits as drivers. And just the simple thing of having the sign and the warning seems to be making a big difference. The other thing that I think is really significant about our red light cameras is that we are seeing now, after a number of years, some significant reduction in injuries. We've demonstrated a 30% reduction in injuries with our red light cameras. I included a picture of one of our new locations, which is a proposed red light camera at Southeast Foster and Southeast 96. At that location, over 4 years, between 2001 and 2004, we had 84 crashes. 53 of those crashes were red light running related. So you can just see what a huge impact red light running crashes are for us. I think one other really significant fact about our red light cameras is that they write very few tickets per day. Our red light cameras average 4 tickets per day, 4 paid tickets per day. So really backing up what you heard from the officers in the previous panel, we're picking, Chief, from the previous panel, sorry, is that we're catching violators that are entering the red light after it's turned red, a small number of violators, and it's reducing crashes and reducing injuries. In our case, and I've included a map, we've identified another 40 locations throughout the city that are high crash locations, all of which we'd like to continue to evaluate whether there's high enough red light running violations to justify red light cameras. But from our perspective, there's no better tool, more cost-effective tool that we have for addressing this problem, and we appreciate the committee's consideration.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee?
Madam Chair, they get more than 8 locations to stick up their red lights now, don't you, with this bill?
Actually, Chair Burdick, Senator Walker, the current law allows the City of Portland to operate cameras at 12 intersections. This bill would eliminate the ceiling on the number of intersections that a city is allowed to operate cameras within their jurisdiction. Our interest in particular is we currently have 6 intersections with that are being used or that have cameras operating actively today. We expect by the end of this summer that we will hit the ceiling. Our council has chosen to expend general fund money to operate 6 additional cameras in the city of Portland where we have identified a significant red light running.
Okay,
as a result, we'll hit that ceiling at the end of this summer.
Okay, let's stop it here so we make sure we get Mr. Costello so he can answer some of the questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Troy Costales, Administrator of the Safety Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. Two areas I'd like to quickly highlight outside of the previous testimony is, one, within the department there are 3 operational issues around red light running and the programs that exist. One, the DMV process. Part of what is in statute is a requirement for speed in relationship to a return back from DMV to the jurisdiction in relationship to the registered owner and the information in order for processing of the citation, which then is a set-aside program within DMV because typically that type of process does not work in the normal judicial system. Second, the department is responsible for the Oregon Traffic Control Devices Committee. That committee is made up of city, county, and state engineers and program managers that create and have published red light running guidelines in relationship to the establishment of the signs and the configuration of the traffic detectors and the cameras and the lights that flash in the evening and during the day. And so these are out there in particular in relationship to whenever there's a intersection that is also involving a state highway. So this is out there. And third, as Mr. Campbell had pointed out, current law, we produce a report on March 1st along with the cities that are involved in the program, which is a bit redundant, but also time issue because they're due on March 1st, as is our summary report is due on March 1st. And so we really don't add value to that process for the reports coming to legislature. The more detailed information is in the individual city reports. The second is on the program side. As Mr. Campbell mentioned, this is a big deal relating to driver behavior, but it is also a very high impact and probably one of the most effective things that can be done around pedestrian safety. One of the Newberg videos you did not see is a mother pushing a baby stroller. She's on the front island to cross. She looks downstream, pauses. You see her physically pause because the car runs through the red light. Had she been on the far side of the intersection, she would have perceived that that vehicle was going to stop because it was far enough away and would have been in the crosswalk on the other side. That's the type of thing you're trying to change. Does it reduce death and injuries? Yes. Does the red light running program? Does it reduce overall crashes? In some cases, no, but you change the dynamic of the crash. Instead of a T-bone, which is the least amount of protection you have as a driver, a vehicle hitting you, you now end up with situations of some rear-end crashes. Those are much less in severity, and eventually those will also decline in a red light running situation in the program. One of the questions came, that Senator Beyer asked in relationship to city council or somebody like that being involved in the program. By inference, in the bill on line 5 at the far right, it says at its own cost. The impression is that if a jurisdiction is going to be getting into a program expending money, that they've likely gone forward to somebody because there is an expense, as Portland's pointed out, where they're going forward to their council to deal with getting approval to be able to expend money. In the photo radar program, which is the standalone van situation in school zones, et cetera, that law explicitly says there has to be approval of the program. In the photo red light, it's implied because there's a cost involved that there's likely somebody within the jurisdiction that has oversight, particularly because there's purse strings attached to it. And with that, Madam Chair, that's all I have, and be more than happy to try and answer any questions that you or the committee may have.
Thank you. Questions from Senator Beyer.
On that issue, I mean, if there is a city of Portland who's got a traffic budget and if a traffic manager, whatever they got, if they want to go ahead and do this without a vote of the city council, there is nothing in statute where it requires a city council vote or any kind of a vote.
Senator Beyer, sorry, I've lost my glasses, but my sunglasses. In the city's case, we have to pass an ordinance for the purpose of letting the contract. If we're going to, in our case, where we get work through a vendor to apply the services.
So, in effect, the council does address the issue by letting a contract, and then, of course, we solicit bids through that solicitation process. Ultimately, when the contract is awarded, the council has to sign off on that contract.
I'm going to let Kevin address this point, too, if somebody can let him sit down for a minute, as to why the specific council approval isn't required in this.
Yeah, Chair Burdick and members of the committee, we have no problem with that at all. We envision no circumstance where we really want any of these to move forward without council approval in any city. I think it's perfectly reasonable to add that explicitly, even though we believe because of the purse string issue, we think it's going to happen that way. We would be fine with adding an amendment that would make it clear that the city council would have to approve.
I think it would be good to have it be consistent, have the same kind of language as the photo radar.
Madam Chair,
question.
Let's take the next step that we talked about earlier. How about a vote of the city people?
Chair Burdick and members of the people, I think I've lost it for the day now. So whatever comes out of my mouth, please don't hold me to it. But our opinion is that in most circumstances, the population has to be supportive of this. But the bottom line is, we don't go to the vote of the people on everything that you consider for a very good reason. You're elected for the purpose of representing a constituency. And so city councilors are regularly removed and replaced over issues like this where decisions are made in violation of the public trust or where the public does not support. I also would say that sometimes your vote, and you know this from experience, is a difficult vote that the public later appreciates but may not appreciate on the front end. The city council has the ability to look fully at the details. The way this program would work would be able to spend a lot of time with the impacts and the potentials for it. And we believe that the city council should be the body to make that decision. Although I understand your perspective on that, we would prefer to keep it a city council decision.
I think Senator Byer would prefer to see no red light radar.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, we can talk later.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Very quickly, Andrew. Thank you, Troy.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, Andrew Morrow, legislative director on the ACLU. Mark, I am testifying. I wanted to bring forward a dynamic in the law that I was pointing out to Senator Beyer, which is the photo radar law 438 and 439. I was hoping that we could fix it in this bill, but I don't think we can. But that's where the city council makes findings and requires the particular specifics be enforced before a city can do it. And the problem with 438, which sets forth the jurisdictions that can do it in the first part, but then sets forth the details of when it can be done and where it can be done and how many feet. That section exists in 438. 439 further sets forth how a jurisdiction can use photo radar and in what conditions have to be met first. So you've got two statutes. The Court of Appeals said that because 439 starts out with the language, notwithstanding any other provision of the law, the following conditions must be met. And the Court of Appeals said that means only 439 conditions must be met. And all those conditions you have set forth in 438, they don't matter. The city does not need to make that happen. I want to point out, and I have to concede, this is personal experience that I'm speaking of, having been a recipient of a photo radar on a bridge in the city of Portland.
Photo radar or red light?
Photo radar. It was not a red light. It was a van that supposedly was there.
This is a red light hearing.
True, but I wanted to make an analogy because if you're talking about the city making findings, you have a problem if you simply mirror it after the current statute with the city making findings based on photo radar. That language has not been adhered to, and if you want to make a city finding that an area should have a photo radar or a photo red light, it needs to be very explicit. And the point simply was is that under 438, it says it can only be a residential or school zone, and they must make findings of a negative effect. The bridge of City of Portland is not a school zone, and it is not a residential. And the City of Portland simply passed an ordinance making a finding that basically all areas almost ostensibly are a safety risk. So I point that out as a way that I think cities need to be held accountable a little bit more on when they do this.
Okay.
And if we could ever fix that section, I'd love to do it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Questions from the committee? Thank you. We will close the hearing on House Bill 2508, and we are going to move House Bill 2333 to tomorrow's agenda. And any other business?
127.
We're going to hold on to it. And we are adjourned. Think about it.